So there's this whole idea of the full thyroid panel. You wouldn't believe how many people ask me for a full thyroid panel. That is, there's no such thing as a full thyroid panel. It doesn't exist. It was made up by somebody, probably some sort of wellness space that was like, oh, your endocrinologist is not doing the full thyroid panel. Let me offer you this expensive full thyroid panel because they're not evaluating it thoroughly enough. And here's what it is. But it's different for every single person that's ordering it because it doesn't actually exist. It's made up.
Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health. All right, welcome back to the Nutrition Science Podcast. Today, I have a very special guest on the show, Dr. Aarthi Thungudu, and she is a triple board-certified physician, a specialist in endocrinology, diabetes, and thyroid disease. And in addition to treating patients as a physician, she's also an entrepreneur. She's the founder of Complete Medicine, a direct care endocrinology-based practice out of Texas. And I want to talk about direct care with Dr. Thungudu another time because there's different options in terms of healthcare, and she's very well-versed in all of the various options in healthcare. And it's a really interesting topic. So we'll probably bring you back on to talk about that topic as well. She's the founder of Complete Medicine, also the founder of Hey Healthy, which is a company that provides accessible and supportive diabetes and hormonal care for self-insured businesses. This is another alternative form of healthcare outside of like the traditional insurance model. So that's Dr. Thungudu is very, very well versed in these things. And I might have to bring her on to talk about these things as well. But in addition to all of this, she's also an amazing mom to two beautiful young children and really like one of the most inspiring humans I've ever met in terms of like really just being a great entrepreneur, great businesswoman, really smart individual. And then also just a really great mom and present in all of that as well, because I know that's really hard to balance. So really appreciate you coming on the show today, Dr. Thungudu.
Thanks so much for having me. And that was such a kind intro. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. And today, I know we talked about, you know, you're board certified in endocrinology, diabetes medicine, thyroid disease. Today, we're going to talk about thyroid because this is something that we have a lot of questions about. This is a very common condition that is becoming more common. People are becoming more aware of it. So what I want to discuss today is we're going to discuss what thyroid disease is. We're also going to talk about, you know, what are some of the signs and symptoms of thyroid dysfunction? How do we test for it? What are the available treatments for thyroid conditions? How nutrition and supplements may play a role? And then any other important topics that come up as we go through this. So thank you for coming on. Let's go ahead and jump into the topic. Let's start with discussing what the thyroid is. Like, what is its function? Where is it located? Let's get started with the basics.
Okay, so the thyroid is a beautiful butterfly-shaped organ in your neck, kind of the lower part of your neck. It's pretty small, but it has a lot of very important functions. So it's small and mighty. It affects metabolism in many different ways. It has to do with heart rate regulation, blood pressure regulation, your heart's rhythm as well, your cold intolerance, heat intolerance. It can affect your eyes. It can also affect your mood. Hypothyroidism can cause low mood or depressive mood. Hyperthyroidism can cause anxiety. It can affect your hair, your skin. It basically affects your whole body.
Mm-hmm. And so the thyroid, it produces hormones. What are those hormones?
Yeah, so the thyroid produces several hormones. Active thyroid hormone is something called T3. The numbers reflect the number of iodine molecules on the compound. And so that is the active thyroid hormone. The other one that we talk about often is T4, which gets converted to T3 as our body needs it. So those are the big ones. There's one called reverse T3 that is kind of overblown in the wellness space at this point. It is an inert version of T3. So there's active T3 that is metabolically active and reverse T3 that is not. The impact of reverse T3, based on the science and literature that we have, is not as great as what is seen in the wellness world. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to touch upon that, mm-hmm. that hormone, so people are aware of what it does or what it doesn't do. There's There's a lot of thyroid experts in quotes that say reverse T3, when it's high, it suppresses active T3. Well, active T3 binds to the receptor with so much more affinity than the reverse T3 that if active T3 is there and reverse T3 is there, then there's no chance that that reverse T3 is actually going to bind. And so that high reverse T3 really is not going to inhibit active T3 because it can't bind the receptor if T3 is available. That's a little bit of basic biochemistry.
Back up a little bit because I want to make sure everyone understands it. So the thyroid, it's producing T4 or is it also producing T3?
So the thyroid produces mostly T4. But it does produce some T3. So there's a couple of ways to get active thyroid hormone. One is the thyroid produces T4, and then the body peripherally converts T4 to T3 as it needs it. But approximately 20% of the T3 is actually produced by the thyroid. So in patients who have had their thyroid completely removed, like they had thyroid cancer or a large nodule, they may have less T3 than they need, even if they are supplemented with T4, which is our typical first line thyroid medication or supplemental thyroid hormone is usually in the form of T4. We call it levothyroxine, Synthroid, Unithroid. Most people with hypothyroidism are familiar with those medications, but in patients who have had their thyroid completely removed, they may feel that they don't feel completely normal on T4 alone because some of the T3 is actually produced directly from the thyroid.
Okay. So the T4 and T3 are both produced by the thyroid. Is reverse T3, is that produced by the thyroid as well?
So T4 can convert to T3 or it can convert to reverse T3.
Okay.
And so, if everything is working normally, T4 converts to T3 as the body needs.
Okay. So the thyroid produces T4. The thyroid produces T4, some T3, and then our body will convert that T4 into T3 as needed in order to keep T3 levels because that's the active form. And you mentioned it binds with a certain affinity. That means that it'll have a stronger bond. So if you think of like these hormones, they're magnets and one of them is just a lot stronger than the other. So if these two magnets are both in the location of that receptor, the one that has a stronger affinity is going to bind and it's going to push the other one out the way. So if the reason that we were discussing this is because you hear a lot of people say, if you have high reverse T3, it's messing up your thyroid and it's, you know, binding to the receptors and not allowing you to have active thyroid hormone. And that's a big thing that is very popular in the wellness space and and it's not accurate. And so that's why we wanted to mention that here is because that reverse T3, it isn't actually interfering with that binding of the normal T3. What causes higher amounts of reverse T3?
I honestly don't really know. You know, it's a variable number, right? And so there's a reference range and it depends on how much T3 your body actually needs, you know? Mm-hmm. So if your tissues are seeing enough active T3, then and there's, you know, more T4 available, then it's going to convert some of that T4 to reverse T3 because you have enough
That makes sense.
T3 okay. Available for the tissues. So the reference range is like, we don't even check it in the endocrinology world because it gives such confusing results because, okay, it's high. Well, if the patient's TSH is normal and they're feeling fine and all of these things, or even if they're not feeling fine, we have to search for a reason why they aren't. Not this. So we don't check it because it gives such confusing information. You know, I think there's this idea that, test for every single thing so that I can have more information. But when we're doing blood tests or even imaging studies, we have to remember that those things are only indicated if they're clinically indicated. So it's not very helpful to do like a pan scan, which would be like a scan from your head to your toes, if it's not clinically indicated, because yeah, there's going to be an abnormality. And is it safer to chase that little cystic abnormality that you find somewhere in your nose, you know, with a scope and then all this stuff that has more potential for risk than benefit? Probably not. So yeah, I think overtesting, I mean, we see this in data all the time, but overtesting can certainly lead to over procedurizing and over treating and higher risk. So when we're thinking about choosing our tests, we need to make sure we're doing that in with an astute expert in that space who's thinking about the whole clinical picture of the patient and assessing risk and benefit.
I am really glad you brought that up, because this is a point over, you know, it goes beyond just thyroid testing. Is we tend to, it seems like when we hear the idea that we need to test more, and you'll hear people say guess, or, you know, test, don't guess, and they're selling commercial tests and they're telling you that they can run all of these specialized labs. The reality is that when we test too many things, there's something's going to be off. And that's part of the business plan with a lot of these companies, is they'll say, we're going to test, we're going to run a panel and we're going to test all of your hormones and reverse T3 and stool test. And what they're going to do is they're going to use some of those numbers that are, you know, quote unquote abnormal. And they may be abnormal just by chance, because they ran 250 tests and 15 of them are going to be out of range just by chance. And so we have to be careful with people who are overselling too much testing. So when it comes to testing, what are the things that someone really, and I know you, at the end of the day, someone needs to be working with their physician. What are the basic tests to test thyroid function that most people want to be paying attention to?
Yeah, I'm going to get on my high horse for a second and talk about that in one more detail, and then I'll address that question. So the U.S. healthcare system has created a system where you spend 5 minutes with your clinician, if you can even get in with them, and it's grossly insufficient. And so what people have done is they've overcompensated with overtesting. It's kind of like a CYA, cover your, you know what, by ordering a bunch of tests. And also it makes people feel more comfortable, right? Because their doctor isn't providing them support and comfort, and they don't have that relationship anymore. So they're trying to seek comfort in this other way that the healthcare system is profiting off of. So it's a big systematic problem. It is, the patients are not to blame for asking for testing. It's that we need to be in a place where we can provide better real care than fake expensive care.
I'm so glad you're just bringing up the best points. And this is why I wanted to bring you on to talk about alternative healthcare at some point, or alternative models of healthcare outside of the insurance models, because that's the reality, is a lot of times we're substituting the actual human care that needs to be provided with fancy testing and supplements and all of these other things, when the reality is you just need to talk to a human who understands the disease and can walk you through the process of actually following the evidence of what's important here.
Yeah, we'll have to do a whole episode on this, because, you know, we could talk about it all day. But back to the thyroid. So the basic main screening test to see if somebody has thyroid disease, which most people probably should have sometime in their life, is a TSH. Definitely if you're pregnant or if you're having any symptoms of hyper or hypothyroid. So TSH is the gold standard for diagnosis of hypothyroidism or underactive thyroid. It is the most sensitive and accurate test that we have. There are other tests that can, so there's this whole idea of the full thyroid panel. Like, you wouldn't believe, or maybe you would believe, how many people ask me for a full thyroid panel. That is, there's no such thing as a full thyroid panel. It doesn't exist. It was made up by somebody in probably some sort of wellness space that was like, oh, your endocrinologist is not doing the full thyroid panel. Let me offer you this expensive full thyroid panel because they're not evaluating it thoroughly enough. And here's what it is. But it's different for every single person. that's ordering it because it doesn't actually exist. It's made up. And so
I've heard of the full thyroid panel. I know exactly what comes in. The ones that I've heard of, it's like T3, T4, reverse T3, TSH, and then usually like
PPO antibodies.
Oh, yeah, GPO, somebody
thyroglobulin yeah. antibodies. Sometimes they'll even do TSI, TB2. Like these, some of these are expensive tests. TSH is super inexpensive. And like globulins, people can charge so much for them because people think they're like a fancy test, you know? And so, and unfortunately, our patients are the ones who are footing those bills and being prey to that misinformation. So TSH is a gold standard. It is an ultra-sensitive TSH. The lab assay is very accurate, okay? It's very strong. Free T4 is another very accurate, like the result that you get is very consistent and accurate. Sometimes we use it in hypothyroidism, but honestly, it doesn't change management unless we're talking about secondary hypothyroidism, which is much less common. So primary hypothyroidism is like Hashimoto's or somebody who's had a partial or total thyroidectomy. It's hypothyroidism that's coming from the thyroid. There's another organ called the pituitary gland that secretes thyroid-stimulating hormone, which is a pituitary hormone that stimulates the thyroid to produce thyroid hormone. And some people who've had head trauma are on certain medications, they might have secondary hypothyroidism that originates from the pituitary, where free T4 is the way we monitor whether their treatment is where it needs to be. But for the most part, TSH is how we diagnose and monitor hypothyroidism, primary hypothyroidism. Now, if you have your thyroid and you are hypothyroid, you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, okay? And so a lot of patients will say, well, I've had hypothyroidism for 30 years and I was only diagnosed with Hashimoto's like 2 years ago. And no, that's not true. You had Hashimoto's the whole time. The antibody testing isn't necessary to know that. Perhaps your doctor didn't tell you that at that time, because 20 years ago, nobody cared. You know, patients with hypothyroidism weren't looking at Instagram at wellness influencers telling them about their Hashimoto's, right? And so, but most patients with Hashimoto's hypothyroidism will have thyroid peroxidase antibodies present, but there are also individuals, myself included, who have positive thyroid peroxidase antibodies that are elevated but have normal thyroid function. So they may have Hashimoto's, they may develop hypothyroidism in the future. The only reason I checked it on myself was because my mom and my dad both have Hashimoto's and a lot of my family members on both sides have it. So I was like, I wonder if I have antibodies. And if I do, then I'll check my TSH every year. And then another antibody is thyroglobulin antibody, less common than thyroid peroxidase antibody, but still fairly common. But about 5% of people with Hashimoto's hypothyroidism don't have any antibodies at all. So they still have Hashimoto's. They just don't have detectably present antibodies in their serum. So that's why these antibodies aren't necessary for making a diagnosis. And the only real reason to check them is if a patient is curious. Otherwise, the level of antibody, the titer of the antibody, does not correlate with disease activity or process. So, for example, I've had patients who have an extremely high TPO antibody of like more than 30,000. It's very, very high, but totally normal TSH, no symptoms, and they're fine.
Wow.
I even have positive thyroid peroxidase antibodies, but I don't have hypothyroidism and I don't treat it. I live as healthy of a lifestyle as I possibly can. But other than that, you know, I don't try to bring down that antibody level. On the flip side, I've had people with mildly elevated TPO antibodies or negative TPO antibodies who have hypothyroidism and symptoms and that improve with treatment. So we can't correlate that antibody number to the disease activity and therefore trying to just simply bring down that antibody level hasn't demonstrated effect in reducing the symptomatology of hypothyroidism or slowing the progression. There are some people who there is like this like group of clinicians who are like, well, my patient went on a plant-based diet and their thyroid antibodies went down and they feel better. And, you know, everybody's going to feel better when they eat a cleaner diet. So you can't really say that feeling better has to do with the antibody change with that.
Yeah. Okay. Great points. So we don't want to, like, measuring antibodies doesn't really make that much sense in most people. Unless you're curious, you can measure it. But generally speaking, if you have low thyroid, you have Hashimoto's.
You have gotten your thyroid removed. If you have your thyroid and you have hypothyroidism, more than likely it is Hashimoto's.
Yeah. So you can just kind of lump that into that bucket. If you have your thyroid, have low thyroid, then it's an autoimmune reaction most likely. And you don't have to test for it because testing for it, like you said, is going to be interesting, but it's not going to give us actionable data. Like, you don't necessarily want to. And I see this all the time. And this is like, I didn't really know this as you're describing it. I'm like, I see people posting like before and after antibodies of putting people on diets and like talking about thyroid antibodies and how they improve them. And so we don't want to pay attention to that. That's not what we're looking to do. So when I want to back up a little bit, because we talked about testing and I know we kind of scraped over the surface of like symptoms. What are the things that would cause someone to really pursue testing if they were really thinking that this might be an issue for them?
Yeah. So hypothyroidism, I like to think of it as like a systematic slowing down. So cognitive slowing, depressed mood, feeling low, feeling cold all the time when other people aren't, hair loss, especially in the temporal region, the distal part of your eyebrows you may lose some hair, dry skin, constipation, those types of things. So slowing down, whereas hyperthyroid or overactive thyroid is an overall speeding up. So heat intolerance, feeling really hot all the time, clammy, anxiety, weight loss. You can have like clammy, moist skin. Yeah, so overall speeding up. Tachycardia, your heart racing, high blood pressure. You can even have cardiac arrhythmias. So this is actually an interesting point. A lot of people are like, oh, I wish I was hyperthyroid because people think that it'll cause weight loss. Well, it might, but more likely it's going to cause things like cardiac arrhythmias, atrial fibrillation, which you can throw a clot and have a stroke if you have that, osteopenia, if you have a fracture. Risk of mortality goes up tremendously with hip fractures. So these are very important, significant potential downsides of hyperthyroidism that many people aren't aware of. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have your thyroid in range. It's not good to have it low. It's not good to have it high. It's kind of like blood sugar, right? We don't want it low and we don't want it high. And then now that we're talking about, we talked about testing for hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. For hyperthyroidism, we want to check free T4 and total T3. I see this one got like wrong all the time. So free T4, total T3. Oftentimes people check free T3, which in theory, it kind of makes sense. Like, you want to know how much T3 is available for your tissues, which should be free T3. And in an ideal world, I would love to know what a patient's free T3 is. The problem is the commercially available assays are bad. And so they're very inaccurate. So when we compare...
Let me back up quickly, because yeah. I know some people may not know what you're referring to there. So with that, sometimes, and from a consumer standpoint, we don't recognize this a lot of times, but sometimes these lab tests they're just not very accurate. And that's the issue with the free T3 is they're just not very accurate. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's like when you get a result that you don't even know if it's true. So you just need to throw it in the trash. That's what we feel about tree T3.
You have to be skeptical about it because it's either it's not valid or reliable, meaning it's not going to give the same result over and over again if you measured it. And so having something that is going to give you a number that may be off by a certain percentage, you can't feel very confident in measuring that. And so that's oftentimes why we, you know, what we were talking about earlier, the over-testing, and you'll hear me talk about this in other episodes as well, of like, we need to avoid testing these things. And it sounds great, but a lot of the times we just don't have great ways of measuring things, unfortunately. And we wish we did. Wish we could just measure your gut microbiome and all of your hormones and have great data on all that. But we don't have ways to do that very well yet because the technology hasn't really gotten there. And we don't, a lot of times you don't hear that side of things. We just think, oh, it's a test, it's good. And that's not always the case.
Yeah. And it's hard to wrap your head around too. I think that you kind of assume that if the lab processes it and they give you a result, it's meaningful. But in the hormone and endocrinology space, it's quite complicated. So with the T3, you know, there are studies like in academic settings or testing labs that they can actually get a accurate T3 level, like with mass spec, or that's a testing, a type of testing. But like, we have a different type of testing that's commercially available. And when they're compared, they're not the same. And so we know that the testing is not accurate on the commercially available side. But in endocrinology, there's a reference range, of course, that the lab spits out. But hormones always act in reference to others. So, and there's always like the reference range is only valid for this specific population at this specific time of day in this specific setting. And so you really need somebody who knows how to interpret that for you to assess what the lab spit out. For example, I had a patient, not a thyroid patient, but somebody that we were screening for Cushing's, which is excessive cortisol. And the lab said that the result was low, but we had done an overnight dexamethasone suppression test. So the patient actually, the test was normal. It said he didn't have Cushing's, but to somebody who didn't know the whole picture, we would have thought this patient had like a problem where he wasn't producing enough cortisol, you know? And so most hormonal tests are like that. So they're more complicated than your typical like lipid panel or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, they need to be evaluated in context of the other hormones that are important in relationship to whatever symptoms are going on. So yeah, that is definitely, and that's why, and I'm going to do a whole episode on this soon, but that's why I'm just want people to be really skeptical of commercial lab tests, because there's a variety of different types of commercial lab tests that are being sold directly to consumers and that are being sold with just incomplete claims. They're saying that they can measure food sensitivities and like Dutch testing is another one that I want to discuss.
I have a whole highlight on that if you guys want to learn about that.
I will send anyone, if anyone wants to learn more about Dutch testing, I'm going to link Dr. Arthi's highlight into the show notes so that you can go check that out. Because
spoiler alert, it sucks. Don't do it.
And I will definitely cover this on another episode. I have one planned in a couple of months where I want to cover each of the commercially available tests and just put it all into one episode, because there's just so much around this. So I'm glad you cleared that up for us. So if someone does find out that they have thyroid disease, so for example, they get a test, they are hyper or hypo, what are the available treatment options? And then also, and because this is a nutrition podcast, and I know you're just as excited about the opportunities of how nutrition and lifestyle can help people. So let's talk about the treatment options in terms of medication. And then is there anything else in terms of nutrition, lifestyle that can be helpful for people?
Okay. So first, lifestyle and nutrition is always helpful, no matter who you are. So if you're a person with thyroid disease, absolutely, we should all be engaging in that. So I think there are a few things that are commonly discussed a few nutrition things that are commonly discussed with thyroid. So I'll address those. And if there are more that you think of, we'll address those. So first and foremost is iodine. I feel like this is always, always brought up in the space of thyroid. So yes, the thyroid needs iodine to produce thyroid hormone. So in areas where iodine deficiency is common, that can actually cause hypothyroidism and, you know, endemic goiter. I'm sure you've seen those pictures of kids in Africa with giant goiters, things like that. We have iodized salt in the United States because of that. So if you have even like a teaspoon of iodized salt, you will have sufficient iodine for the day. The daily, like the recommended daily allowance is about 150 micrograms. If you're pregnant, 250. So it's not very much that you need. And on the flip side, excessive iodine can cause major unpredictable issues with the thyroid. So it can cause profound hypothyroidism. It can cause profound hyperthyroidism and in an unpredictable fashion. So a lot of these thyroid supplements that you can see at like GNC and stuff have a ton of iodine or kelp. Kelp is like a bunch of iodine. So I highly recommend avoiding those. I've seen so many patients with thyrotoxicosis or really sick with hyperthyroidism due to iodine supplements that they bought off the shelf that some clinician recommended to them.
I started working with a client who was recommended a thyroid supplement that had 1 gram of iodine in it per day. And I, like, when I saw it, I was like, please tell me you haven't been taking this. And she was like, no, I took it on and off, but I was never consistent with it. I was like, good, because that would have worsened things for you most likely if you were very consistent with it. Because, yeah, that's a very, I mean, people are giving themselves thyroid conditions, I think, in some cases with, and unfortunately, a lot of times it's coming from recommendations from this was a functional medicine doctor.
And that's where it always comes from. But
exactly.
But yeah, so I mean, I've seen patients in the hospital with this stuff. You know, it's hyperthyroidism. Thyrotoxicosis is not something that's like a mild disorder. I've seen people die from it. I've seen people have to get emergency thyroidectomy. Like, it is not something we want to mess around with. Iodine is not something that we want to mess around with at all. Yes, you need some, but you're probably getting it in your diet. If you live in the United States, even our fruits and veggies have some in it.
One of the things I want to mention, though, is there are a lot of people who are trying to be healthier and they're choosing like sea salt and other salts that are non-iodized. I recommend against that. Like, just go with the iodized salt so that you make sure you get some iodine, because otherwise, you know, you're unless you're eating seafood and you know, certain like green sea vegetables and things like that, you're probably not going to be getting enough iodine if you are. And this, I feel like it's a very small percentage of the population of people who are eating almost no processed foods, and then they're not salting their foods with iodized salt. So they're getting like just very low amounts, because I have recommended to a few clients to start using iodized salt because they're avoiding it. And they were also avoiding like just most processed foods. So their overall sodium consumption was lower and their overall iodine consumption was on.
I actually don't think that added salt in processed foods even has iodine.
Oh yeah, I don't think it is. I don't think it does either. I think it depends on the company. I tried to find information on that, and it's like just completely up to the company, I think, and they don't list it on the back. I see when it says sea salt, I don't know if it's iodized when it's regular salt.
Yeah. And so I think, yeah, have some iodized salt, but you don't need a lot. It's a very small amount that you need. Like literally a teaspoon. And so, or perhaps even less would be fine for most people. So it's not like we're trying to get you to, of course, we have a lot of people are concerned with their sodium consumption, which is definitely reasonable too, but getting some iodized salt will be sufficient and safer than getting an iodine supplement. So that's one big one. And then soy is another one that we talk about or people get concerned about often. So there have been studies on this. The data is fairly inconclusive that soy impairs thyroid function. The one thing that we have noticed is people that ingest a high soy diet may have higher requirements of levothyroxine or thyroid supplementation if they have hypothyroidism. But it's just an absorption issue. It's not that the soy is making the thyroid not work as well. So if you start to notice that your thyroid requirement is going up and you're eating more soy than you did in the past, it could be related to the soy, but it doesn't mean you necessarily need to change it. The only issue there is if you're inconsistent with the soy consumption, then your requirement for thyroid hormone may be changing. So adding consistency to that, if it is affecting your thyroid hormone supplement, like your medication level, that might be prudent. Another thing is selenium. This is another element that we do need for thyroid hormone production. It can be found in Brazil nuts. Most of us are getting enough. Supplements can cause abnormalities in your thyroid, so I don't recommend supplements again. If you are concerned, like 5 Brazil nuts a month is probably sufficient. Do you have anything to add to that, Adrian?
No, I completely agree in terms of selenium. If you're just eating, I mean, most people are getting plenty of selenium though, and it's, if you just added a couple of Brazil nuts, 1 or 2 a week, you're gonna be there for sure.
Yeah, and if you're concerned, that's how I would do it. Another one is cruciferous vegetables. So like broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts. People are scared of these things. I guess what I've read, like the historical context, is that like in the 1950s or 1930s, they thought that these vegetables could be goitrogenic. What that means is causing a goiter or enlargement of the thyroid. But like several studies have demonstrated that that's like kind of invalidated that. And these are super healthy vegetables. And so you don't need to get rid of them from your diet for the sake of your thyroid, you know? And
I covered this on the last episode. I think it'll probably be the last episode that I just published before this one, where I covered actually what was going on with the cruciferous vegetables and the goitrogens and all the misinformation around that. Cause the episode is about anti-nutrients and plant toxins.
Oh, so I can't wait to listen to that one. Yeah.
Cruciferous vegetables is a part of that.
Cool. And then what else do people think about a lot with the thyroid?
Gluten.
Oh yeah, gluten. How could I miss that one? So a gluten-free diet is like probably the first thing that people think that they need to do when they learn that they might have a problem with their thyroid or they think that they have a thyroid issue. So there is another autoimmune disease called celiac disease. And that is gluten intolerance. So basically, people with celiac disease have bloating and diarrhea if they eat gluten, and malabsorption. That means they don't absorb the nutrient that they should. And it has to do with the intestinal absorptive surface that gets affected by gluten. Now, if somebody does not have celiac disease, they don't have that issue going on. Thing is that Hashimoto's hypothyroidism is an autoimmune disease, and so is celiac disease. And when you have one, you're more likely to have the other. The good news is there's serological testing that can tell you whether you have celiac disease or not. So if you have Hashimoto's and you don't have celiac disease, you don't have a medical reason to avoid gluten. Now, there are also other people who have gluten insensitivity, like they just feel bad when they eat gluten. They don't have documented celiac disease, but gluten makes them feel bad. In that case, then yeah, avoid gluten, but not for the sake of your thyroid. Gluten-free diets don't decrease your need for thyroid hormone outside of the setting of celiac disease, and they don't like increase the speed of worsening of hypothyroidism. So unless you have celiac disease or gluten insensitivity, there's no need to avoid gluten for hypothyroidism only.
And there was a study that, so some people will see this study because I've seen it online, and it kind of convinces people to go the other direction. There was one study that was published, I think it was published in 2017, where they had people with low thyroid go on a gluten-free diet. They went on this gluten-free diet and the antibodies went down a little bit. Now we know that that's not important. The antibodies going down, need for medication didn't change. Thyroid hormones didn't change. But that study has been, I've seen it cited many times for people trying to justify going on a gluten-free diet. They had no control group. It was one group. It was self-selected. Like they didn't even randomize them. They just found people who wanted to go gluten-free. And then they looked at antibodies pre and post. So you may come across this if you haven't already. I've seen this cited many times of people using that as a justification for telling people to go gluten-free. And it doesn't make sense. If you don't have, you know, celiac disease or not, or you don't experience negative symptoms when you eat gluten, like any type of digestive or any other like joint pain or anything like that, then it shouldn't be an issue and you shouldn't need to avoid it. And it's not going to benefit your thyroid if you do avoid it. So that's in terms of nutrition, talked about iodine, important. And then soy is not an issue. Cruciferous vegetables, not an issue. Gluten, not an issue. Soy can be an issue with the amount of medication that you need because it influences absorption a bit. So that's what we need to pay attention to there in terms of like overall nutrition, because this is something that I talk about quite a bit, is overall nutrition when it comes to autoimmune conditions or in thyroid, you know, disease specifically, all of the same stuff applies for the most part. You still need, you know, mostly unprocessed foods, nutrient dense diet, all of these things still apply. It's not that you have to eat a completely different disease. There just may be some small tweaks that you need to make for your own self that may be a little bit different than other people. And so outside of nutrition, I know we kind of touched on medications a little bit, but can we talk about that really quickly before we close out? And then also, and one of the reasons I want to bring that up is because I know sometimes there's alternative medications that people turn to, and I want to make sure that we discuss that as well.
Sure. Okay. So let's start with hypothyroidism because that's the most common. So like we mentioned earlier, there's T4 and there's T3. So synthetic T4 is the most common treatment for hypothyroidism. And that comes by the names of like Synthroid, Levothyroxine, Unithroid, Tyrosine, lots of different names. Now, most people will do okay with T4 only formulations because their body will peripherally convert that T4 to T3 as needed. And when we talk about brand versus generic, there are some people who are very sensitive to dose fluctuations. Okay. So when we have a generic medication like levothyroxine, HEB might contract with a distributing pharmacy in Mexico. One time they get a batch of levothyroxine, the next time they might have a distributing pharmacy in Canada. And so the FDA allows for a little bit of dose discrepancy between your levothyroxine 100. It might be 99.7 one time. And then the next from the other distributing pharmacy, it might be 100.3. Most people, it's totally fine. They won't notice a difference. Their body won't notice a difference. Some people are very sensitive though. And they need a more consistent dosing. Like they need their 100 to be 100.1 every single time. And in those cases, Synthroid can be very helpful because it's always from the same manufacturer, the same manufacturing and distributing pharmacy. So that's why we sometimes will switch somebody from levothyroxine to Synthroid if they're having TSH fluctuations on the same dose that they're taking consistently. And then there's some people who the most common allergic reaction, which is not even common, but is allergies to the dyes. Levothyroxine has dye in it, and it's a different color for each dose. So if a patient is having an allergy to that dye, we may choose a dye-free option like Tyrosine. We also have Tyrosine solution for somebody who can't have a solid. So there are a few different types of medications even in the T4 space, and there's different indications for each. There's also IV levothyroxine for patients who are hospitalized and can't take anything by mouth. Any questions about that, Adrian?
So I've heard people taking like T4 with T3 or something along those lines. What is it? What is that?
Yeah, so that's my next point. So T3 or liothyronine, the brand name is Cytomel, can be used in adjunct to T4 in very small doses for patients who their TSH may have normalized on T4, but they just don't feel well. This could be in a patient with a thyroidectomy whose thyroid is not there to produce any of that 20% of T3. And there are some people who have Hashimoto's, they still have their thyroid, but they're just not feeling quite to where they want to be. Now, T3 is very interesting because it's short acting, whereas T4 is very long acting. By week of action with T4 versus hours of action of T3. So ideally, it really needs to be dosed 3 times a day. We don't typically ask patients to do that because it's exceedingly difficult to do that. And T3 actually has antidepressant qualities to the point which patients with clinical depression, like they see a psychiatrist for depression that is refractory or doesn't respond to other treatments, are recommended T3 even with no thyroid disease. So it is used as an antidepressant as well. So it's not perfectly clear whether we're making people feel better because of the thyroid or because we're making them feel better. But as long as their thyroid numbers are in line, they're not thyrotoxic because of it, it's fairly safe to do it this way. The problem with it is oftentimes patients who are managed by perhaps somebody without enough expertise in this, they are given really high doses of T3 and they become thyrotoxic because of it. And then it becomes very challenging for those patients to reach a state where they feel well in a safe space. Because like I said, we don't want patients having atrial fibrillation or osteoporosis or just hyperthyroidism for any reason. Any more questions about T3 by itself?
The only question I have here, and this is something that I've seen come up, is like, so I've seen people get these medications from like compounding pharmacies. What is that?
So there's different answers to that question. So compounding pharmacies basically can make things that aren't available in like FDA regulated regular pharmacy. So if you need a different dose or different formulation, dye-free, something like that, sometimes compounding can be safe and sometimes it's not. It really depends on the reason and the type of medication. As far as T4 and T3, like, they're commercially available and inexpensive. So there's really no great indication that I can see to compound it. Now, there are formulations that combine T4 and T3, like Armour Thyroid, Nature Throid. And basically, these are desiccated, typically pig thyroid. Some formulations can be bovine, but mostly they're pig. Bovine means cow. So basically, they dry pig thyroid, put it into a pill, and then give it to people, which, you know, in some cases, it can be done safely. It just requires monitoring. The problem is pigs and humans are not the same, and their ratios to T4 and T3 are different. So pigs have way more T3 compared to T4 compared to humans. And so what I've seen clinically is that patients end up thyrotoxic more often. The other thing is there's a lot of dose variability in these, and they're constantly being recalled. And so like every year there's a recall on these medications. So just for dose consistency, it's hard, but in a way it's easier for people to have a combined pill if they need both T4 and T3 than to have two different pills. I don't prescribe it that. I like to be more exact in my prescribing. So I'll usually prescribe T4 and T3. The only reason that I would ever prescribe desiccated porcine thyroid is if a patient is on it, stable, and tried all the other things, doesn't want to change, and they're doing very well on it. But otherwise, I would choose the other more exact formulations.
Okay. That's what I was kind of referring to, because I've heard of this Armour Thyroid and Nature Thyroid, and I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, if your doctor has you on these synthetic thyroid medications, you need to get on this one. So I wanted to make sure and address that, because they're not safe. They're not going to be consistent. There's a lot of recalls. You're just introducing a lot of variability to your health condition that can make it more difficult to manage.
And people like to say they're more natural. I mean, they're naturally pig, but last I heard, we're not treating pigs in this space. So, I mean, it's not similar. It's not the same thing as something that's natural. Not that natural is always good either. I mean, there are illicit drugs that are natural, you know, but we know that they're not safe. So I think that's kind of a way that they're sold, but not necessarily actually meaning they're beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm glad you cleared that up, because there's so many, as I know, just thinking back at all the things we've discussed, I've seen all of this with so many of my clients who have been recommended all of these things, and I just wasn't really that familiar. Like, I'd see all their thyroid labs, and they're sending me these complicated thyroid labs and all of this other stuff just to kind of look over, and I'm like, I don't know. Like, I always refer them out to other, you know, I'm like, maybe you should see another physician, but I'm glad you cleared up quite a bit for me. And I'm sure that everyone listening is also going to be, you know, really thankful for the information that you've shared with us today. So I really appreciate that. Where can our listeners find kind of more information, learn about what you do, and also just learn more from you?
Yeah, I think Instagram is probably the easiest place and where we'll be connected. It's just at Dr. Aarti Thangadu, just DR for doctor, my name Aarti, last name Thangudu. If you're interested in being a patient and you're in Texas or Oklahoma, our direct to consumer website is sacomplete.com. And then if you are a business and you want to have our services for your employees, check out heyhealthy.com. That's our new launch that we're super excited about.
Yeah, thanks so much for sharing that. And if you are someone who is dealing with these thyroid issues and you are in Texas or Oklahoma, go see her. Like, I have recommended many of my clients, like pretty much anyone I work with, I just send them your way. I'm like, please just go work with her as well so that I feel comfortable with everything, you know, all of the care that you're getting overall. So I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this information. And yeah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course.